Welcome to Morning Report Top Stories, a selection of news from Radio New Zealand National's Morning News Programme.
Well, newly minted National Party board member and former MP David Carter says he wouldn't have made the comments President Peter Goodfellow did to 550 delegates over the weekend. Mr. Goodfellow was unanimously re-selected by the board as president on Saturday, despite Mr. Carter receiving the highest number of votes from delegates. Peter Goodfellow then used his speech to direct a tirade against the Labour government.
For an opposition party trying to hold a celebrity government to account for their decisions and policies, it was suddenly a crime for us to ask legitimate questions or comment, and daily broadcasts became televangelistic, like gospel to the masses. Democracy for a period of time gave way to a form of temporary tyranny.
Well, RNZ understands not everyone in the caucus is happy with the outcome, and MPs will gather at Parliament on Wednesday to discuss who will best represent their views on the board, a role traditionally held by the senior whip. Mr. Carter told our political reporter Joe Moyer he didn't hear much of Mr. Goodfellow's speech, but Sir John Key was right to tell leaking MPs to leave the party.
Both as a board member and a former caucus member for 26 years, I totally agree with John Key. If they won't play as a team, they're better off out of it.
And I guess some of those other comments that were made, which you may or may not have heard about through Peter Goodfellow's speech around Jacinda Ardern and her COVID-19 response, him talking about it being televangelical and talking about the media and its clickbait and being biased. Do you think that those sorts of things fed into the end result for the National Party?
I wouldn't have made those comments myself. I think the problems that National had at the last election were entirely of National's making. They needed to be a unified team with a credible message. National failed to do that, and the voters in New Zealand recognised it and responded accordingly. The faults lie with ourselves.
You all had an opportunity to pitch to the delegates. What was your message to them?
My message was that the board needs to do its role of governance. It's a strategic role, and it's part of the National Party family that we need to, that board needs to operate correctly. Not do politics. The politics remains with the caucus. And provided the caucus works well, provided the party works well, provided the board works well, and they all interlink, then we've got a chance of being back stronger for the 2023 election.
And that is National Party board member and former MP David Carter speaking to RNZ's political reporter Joe Moyer.
To US politics now, Donald Trump has continued an unrelenting barrage of challenges to his loss in the presidential election. Among these is the campaign's request for a recount of ballots in the battleground state of Georgia. For those keeping score at home, this will be the third time the votes have been counted in the state. On Friday, election officials in Georgia certified Joe Biden's victory after conducting a hand recount of nearly 5 million ballots. Stephen Fowler is a broadcaster and political reporter in Atlanta and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, this recount, why is it happening again?
Right, so the votes were counted first. And afterwards, before they could certify the results, we did something called a risk-limiting audit, which means that normally it uses math to figure out random ballots to pull to confirm the right person won. Because Georgia's margins were so close, they essentially had to review every single ballot that was cast. So some called it a recount, but it was an audit. And now, because the margins are so close, once it's certified, the loser can request a recount, which is why over the next several days, we're going to see all 5 million ballots counted again, this time put through high-speed scanners, just like they were the first time.
It won't change the result, though, will it?
Definitely not. We've seen some minor variations because, for example, our absentee by mail ballots are filled out by people by hand, and sometimes people don't fully fill in the ovals all the way, and it requires a pair of bipartisan reviewers to say, yes, that's a vote, no, that's not. But the results, the outcome should not change. The final margin might be off by a couple here and there.
Seeing some rather extraordinary claims this morning from Sidney Powell, President Trump's personal lawyer, I think that's the right way of describing her, suggesting that this big thing's going to happen in Georgia and that the governor a Republican governor is somehow involved in a scam to rort the election.
It's frustrating and it's dangerous, this level of misinformation. Georgia is a Republican state, even though it voted for Joe Biden. We have a Republican governor, a Republican top election official. Republicans control both branches of our legislature and passed all of the rules and laws that govern our voting system. And so what this conspiracy alleges is that somehow all of these Republicans banded together with the Democrats. There's something about Hugo Chavez and Venezuela involved, and just really a bunch of nonsense trying to undermine faith in the election. But the reality is, this election was actually the best that Georgia has seen in a long time, with a new voting system, with record turnout, and there is no evidence of any sort of fraud or wrongdoing that could have altered the election.
The other avenue that we've seen is this issue of certifying the results, which is the responsibility, presumably, of the state legislature. Is that right? I mean, is there any issue there in Georgia?
No. So the way the results are happened is last week, counties had to certify their results were correct. Then they did this audit. Some of them discovered they didn't actually count all of the ballots, so the margin shrank a little bit. And then the state election official, Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, certified the election saying all of this is correct and true. Then the governor certified it saying this is true and we will send 16 Democratic electors to the Electoral College to cast votes for Joe Biden. And what we've seen is no evidence. And you look at the court cases. There's been only two court cases filed in Georgia. One was a narrow challenge to a few ballots down on the coast. And one was this long shot lawsuit filed by a Trump aligned attorney who didn't have any evidence. And in fact, the federal judge who was appointed by President Trump said, you have no evidence, you have no standing, you have nothing here. So, you know, all of this rhetoric is harmful. But if you look at the courts, which is where challenges actually happen, there's even more of a big nothing burger, as we say.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. So they're not winning in the courts. But we're still seeing these lawyers go on television, not necessarily all of the channels, Fox and others. Are you getting worried that this is still going, that there is still this these conspiracy theories being thrown out there?
Well, you have to remember that Georgia's voting isn't done. We have two U.S. Senate runoffs for both of our Senate seats January 5th. And if Republicans win, they maintain control of the Senate and have a powerful check against Joe Biden's legislative agenda. If the Democrats win, they have the majority with a tie-breaking vote from Vice President Kamala Harris. And so the stakes in Georgia are really high. And it looks like the Republican strategy and avenue is to pretend like President Trump is going to come back again to get his most fervent supporters to the polls over the holidays to vote for these Republican senators and push them back into office.
And when can we expect to see a bit more certainty? I mean, when will enough of these states certify for enough Republicans to come out publicly? They're slowly turning, I see, Chris Christie and others, but it seems to be a slow process.
You know, I'm not sure that we're really going to see very many people publicly acknowledge that Joe Biden won. For example, Vice President Mike Pence was down campaigning for the senators here on Friday, and without acknowledging Joe Biden, without acknowledging President Trump, he's campaigning for the two senators saying we must hold the majority. So on the one hand, saying that would have to acknowledge that Joe Biden is going to be the next president. But by focusing on Republicans and Trump and the Senate, it kind of is this alternate reality where, you know, President Trump's supporters are still placated and engaged.
Stephen Fowler, really appreciate your time this morning, broadcaster and political reporter in Atlanta. There are fresh calls back here for elected Māori representatives on Auckland Council 10 years after the super city was formed. The Royal Commission, which recommended the amalgamation a decade ago, also proposed Māori seats be part of the new council. The idea was dumped, prompting thousands of people to protest in Auckland CBD. 10 years on, the government looks set to pave the way for councils to do away with public polls when they want to create Māori seats. Auckland Council reporter Jean Bell filed this report.
While Māori seats in the new super city were scrapped, an independent Māori statutory board was established. Its function is to promote issues significant to Māori and ensure the council follows the Treaty of Waitangi. The board's chairman, David Taipari, says the super city has led to more engagement with Māori, but it could be improved. He says consultation with Māori can often come at the tail end of the council's process.
I think that Māori should be right at the forefront when things are being proposed and how they've been developed. And so I think if that became the norm, there would be a number of issues that would be dealt with along the way. But again, sometimes Māori are left in a reactive space, and again, having to sort of advocate for their inclusion on certain matters. And I think it should just be a given where we partnership and work together.
The board has 9 members, and 2 members sit on most council committees with voting rights. Mr. Taipari says this has given Māori a seat at the table.
Providing a cultural perspective, a Māori perspective, where I think that was absolutely lacking, if near nil, when we first came on 10 years ago.
However, Mr. Taipari says Māori seats would further boost representation. John Tamahiri is Chief Executive of Te Whānau o Waiparera Trust, an Auckland-based Māori-focused social service. He is also a former member of the Independent Māori Statutory Board. He says urban Māori lose out to mana whenua and have no voice.
You get first-class iwi mana whenua and you get second-class nobody. A bit of a ugly little class system has arrived, and we get played off against one another, you know, by the masters. And so there is a problem that needs to be resolved there as well in representation.
John Tamahiri is critical of how board members are chosen, and he disagrees with Chairman David Taipari, saying it is a token add-on and has little influence on the council. Mr. Tamahiri wants Māori seats at the council so Māori can pick their elected representatives. Bernie O'Donnell, chairman at the Monaco Urban Māori Authority, agrees with the need for change. He has noticed council relationships with mana whenua have improved, but urban Māori tend to be forgotten.
I just think we're an afterthought. I don't think we're necessarily in front and centre in terms of the council's thinking when it comes to Māori. As I said, their primary goal is to work with mana whenua, and I get that. I get that. But at the same time, we have, as urban Māori communities, our own needs, and we need our, you know, and we're ratepayers just like everyone else, and we tend to be the poor cousin, if you like.
The first moves have already been made to make changes, with local government minister Nanaia Mahuta promising to remove a requirement for public polls when councils want to create Māori seats. Minister Mahuta says in a statement that addressing the issue is a priority, but there is legislative processes that need to be worked through before this happens. Mō te hōtaka o te atene, ko Jimba tēnā.
Simone Anderson, Auckland Council's Acting General Manager of Māori Outcomes, says in a statement Māori identity and wellbeing is a key focus for the council. Ms. Anderson says the council has developed Kia Ora Tamaki Makaurau, a way of tracking progress on Māori outcomes. She says Māori were consulted with to identify issues that matter to Māori while developing this framework, but she did not specify whether it was urban Māori or mana whenua that were spoken to during this process. She says the council has provided targeted support for Māori to help soften the blow of COVID-19 lockdowns.
Nationals members copped a handful of home truths at its AGM over the weekend. Former leader Sir John Key didn't pull his punches on any aspect of the party's performance, which suffered a clobbering in last month's election. He said disunity and a leadership revolving door made National lame ducks at the voting booth. Earlier, I asked Sir John whether he'd sugarcoated his message to the party at all.
No, but I mean, look, it was an important time as we came together after the election to, you know, take stock and have a bit of a reality check that while this was a very unusual election and we were up against one-term government, you know, COVID-19 drowned out every other sort of opportunity to get a message out there, it would be very easy, I think, for us in the National Party to say, well, look, it was solely that, we don't bear any responsibility, tough luck, we'll come back next time in 23. I think that's just a bit too convenient because the reality is that we do have to take some responsibility. We did get some things wrong. And if we don't learn from them, we'll just repeat them and we won't win. So if we're committed enough to winning, then we have to actually have a genuine attempt at analysing what went wrong and then looking to correct it.
Okay, so how should National, how can National reclaim the 413,000 votes, I think it was, that went to other parties? Just how big is this task?
Yeah, well, that's why I sort of quantified. I mean, the 413,800 votes is a huge number of votes. Doesn't mean you can't get them back, but we're not talking about a few people around the corner. We're talking about, you know, more than the entire population of Christchurch. So, I mean, I think there's a few things. Firstly, you have to get control of the media agenda in the way that what they report. And if you don't have, you know, if you stop the leaking, you don't have disunity, all those things, eventually those messages stop, and then the messages that the public start hearing from you are the ones they want to hear, which are the ones about them, and you start to get a chance to say, look, here's a contrast of what we would do as a government, and then you also get a chance to actually critique the government on what they're doing in, you know, in your opinion, wrong and failing in. And so in the end, actually, voters respond to that. What they don't respond to is endless stories about yourself, because that's really not that interesting to them.
OK, so on Peter Goodfellow's speech, he spoke about Jacinda Ardern being televangical. He spoke about it being tyrannical. Is he making a mistake in saying some of those things, which obviously have been picked up by the media? And is he beginning to go down a Trumpian road?
Well, I think in the end it's for the National Party leadership, if you like, to sort of, you know, say the things that they want to say and ultimately to critique that. That's not, you know, really my job these days, because I'm just a
It's maybe not your
leader,
job, but you are, well, you're just a former leader. You're just a very popular former leader, and you're still a significant person within the National Party. So I'm interested in your opinion on what the President is saying and how he's framing things.
Well, what I would say is this is my version of the way we should look at it. I think it's really simple to sit back and say Jacinda Ardern will be easy to beat, and that she'll make mistakes, and that people will tire of her, and that, you know, the government will fail. And that's called the hope strategy. And in my opinion, hope is not a strategy, because if we sit around waiting for Jacinda to make mistakes, then we're not going to win the election in 2023.
Think that Peter Goodfellow has grasped that is a problem? Or do you think...
Well, I think it's a mistake.
Do you think he fails to understand why people have flocked to Jacinda Ardern, and therefore is he the right person to be president of the National Party in the future?
Well, I definitely think he's the right person to be the president of the National Party, because they have a very clear role, which is the glue between the parliamentary and party wing, and as a fundraising, and to head the fundraising efforts for the party. I just think that, you know, when I was Prime Minister, there was a long time where people just said on the other side of the parliamentary benches they would get sick of me. And, of course, you're always going to get sick of someone that's a leader and that's on TV all the time. But the problem with all of that is that, you're not being proactive about what you're doing. You're not actually coming up with alternatives. And, actually, I think what you're going to see is a Labour Party that is going to say, well, OK, National lost 413,000 voters. Well, we gained them. How do we hold on to them? And if we hug the middle ground and we do a reasonable job, then not all of them, but some of them will stay. And if they stay with Labour, we don't win. So I think, again, I just think the most important thing we can do in the National Party is get a mirror out, have a look in it, say these are the things we can control, get on top of that, control those things, and do a really good job of what we're doing. Start going back to what we did for a long time.
Is Peter Goodfellow getting that mirror out? Is he having a look? Is he wanting to see where it went wrong in an perhaps unflattering way, or in an unvarnished way? Would that show that he's listening? And by making the comments he is making, does that show he isn't?
I think he does. But I think you just have to accept that, you know, sometimes when you go to the National Party AGM or you know, a national conference, I mean, you're going to offer a range of different perspectives. Because to be fair, he also offered a perspective that said we have to take personal responsibility for some of the things that went wrong. He offered a range of different views. I chose to go there and say, look, you could go and look at any particular thing you wanted to. But in my opinion, as the former leader of the party, what I do know is that there's a sort of health test or hygiene test that I think voters have.
Mm.
And they generally say, look, if you can't really run yourselves, if you've got all these other different issues, if the general focus of attention is on you, the political party, not me, the voter, then you're just simply not ready to be the government. And now, that will be the strongest factor, in my view, in turning them back to National.
There was, of course, the revolving door of leadership this year. Judith Collins, is she the right leader? Would she make a good prime minister?
I think she'd make an excellent prime minister. As I said, I came in with her in 2002. She's very experienced. She was a very good minister, Judith. And, Judith's a tough operator. And actually, people want that, I think. People want a leader that's confident and knows what they're about.
And that's despite the dirty politics, despite the fact that you sacked her, you still think she'd make a good prime minister?
I do. And I think, you want to, again, take all of those things with a grain of salt. I mean, I did, I believe, absolutely the right thing when there was a situation where she stood down for a period of time, and I did the right thing when I reinstated her. I mean,
so the dirty politics stuff should be taken with a grain of salt.
Well, all I'm sort of saying is that, there's no point really in relitigating all of those kind of issues, and we can all go and look back on things, but my main point really is that's not relevant to the voters of 2023. I think what is relevant is what she does now and over the next 3 years and how she leads the party. And she's got both the mental and physical strength to do that. And she has a very prodigious work rate. I mean, the reality with Judith is she'll work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Mm.
So to me, I think she's absolutely the right person.
But would National have been better sticking with Simon Bridges?
As I said in the speech, you can go through a whole bunch of what ifs. It's sort of pointless, really. Caucuses often change leaders when there is polling issues or when they feel they're not doing well. And actually, to be blunt, there's nothing wrong with a political party changing a leader. I mean, if you go and have a look at Labour in 2017, they changed to Jacinda. Mm. Really a couple of months out from the election, and people would say that was a successful move they made. The party's changed their leader. The issue isn't that. The issue is the way that you do things. And ultimately, what Labour did in 2017, which they, might add, really hadn't done tremendously well for a long time prior to that, was they did coalesce around Jacinda, and they said, well, we believe he'd be the right leader. Andrew Little accepted that decision and proved to be, a solid team member. And so I kind of think that All I would simply say is, again, National's got lessons to learn. If it changes its leader, so be it. But it's got to handle that professionally. I've never argued that they can't argue about all of those things. As I said in my speech in the weekend, it can have discussions about all sorts of things, but it needs to do that in a very professional way, and it needs to deal with itself.
What about the caucus? Is there going to still be disquiet? It appears that leaks are still happening despite the weekend. RNZ, for example, understands that MPs, not all MPs, are happy with Goodfellow remaining in his position. And significant figures like Christopher Luxon, should he be given more responsibility? Should he have more profile, considering his background?
Well, as I said, to go back to where you need to get to, which is talking about the things that are important to voters, will take some time. I don't think, we can do that as a caucus and tighten up very quickly. But ultimately, there'll always, but there's an appetite within the media to report on these matters because it's kind of interesting, isn't it? I mean, that's the way these things happen. So all I'd sort of simply say is, look, I think that the caucus is not silly. It knows that what I'm saying is the tried and true method to be unified and to do the right thing. And I think that you will find that as time rolls on, they will follow that message. I hope they do, because I genuinely believe it to be the right advice.
That's the former leader of the National Party and indeed former Prime Minister, Sir John Key.
New Zealand's relationship with China has come back into sharp focus following last week's criticism of the superpower by the intelligence agency Five Eyes. The Chinese hit back aggressively at a Five Eyes statement signed by New Zealand, which declared Hong Kong's autonomy and freedom of speech had been eroded by its giant neighbour. The exchange, including China's threat to, quote, poke out the eyes of its accusers, has prompted some experts to say New Zealand is walking a fine line with a country that is, of course, overwhelmingly one of our, if not largest, trading partner. We're joined now by the Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern. Good morning.
Good morning.
Poke out our eyes. Is that a threat?
Oh, look, it's not for me, Corin, to interpret the statements of other nations. What I do know, though, is that, you know, on both sides, we've been really consistent on what we've been saying on Hong Kong. I don't think that for China, those statements will be a surprise. We have been, really, as I say, repetitive on some of what we're saying around Hong Kong, and that's been because we do believe that we have an interest there in the number of New Zealanders who do business in Hong Kong, the impact on those here in New Zealand who are affected by it. And so for us, the important thing is that we are consistent. You know, nothing that we say comes as a surprise to China, where our relationship is important. And equally, sure, their response is it's entirely...
Why aren't you interpreting the comments? Why aren't... I mean, what are we supposed to do?
Oh, you were just asking me to give an interpretation over what they mean.
Well, I mean, it's pretty clear, isn't it? I mean, why wouldn't we try and work that out?
Oh, look, I take it as read. Obviously, it is a strong response, but equally, I'm not surprised by a strong response in the same way that they won't be surprised by what we've said because we've been saying it for some time.
Might they be a little bit surprised, though, that we did issue this statement as part of the Five Eyes? What is this? It is a spy alliance. Why did New Zealand sign an agreement on foreign policy, which is effectively a spying network?
It's not an agreement on foreign policy. It was a statement. This is not unusual, Corin. It was signed off by foreign ministers, and we've done the same in August. So since I've been in, it's not been unusual.
Okay, not unusual, but can you explain to New Zealanders what is the rationale for using the Five Eyes Alliance as a mechanism?
Essentially, obviously, a group of partners that we work with closely, where if we have a common view on an issue, we may issue a common statement. This just happens to be an issue where this is the view of New Zealand. It's something that we've said independently and that we're saying collectively as well. And again, it's not unusual for us to do that. Sometimes there'll be occasions where a statement may be made that we don't join. We do have an independent foreign policy that's really important to us. We will make a decision based on whether or not the sentiment is in keeping with our foreign policy position.
There will be some, though, who are worried that perhaps we're moving a little bit further into the Five Eyes. Helen Clark said in the RNZ podcast, The Service, by Guy Espiner and John Daniel, that she believed while the Five Eyes Alliance was a benefit, there was potentially, quote, a bit of slippage there in terms of independence. She went on to say sources in officialdom had told her New Zealand had got, quote, a lot closer back in and that could threaten the country's independent foreign policy. Is that a concern?
I had challenged that. I mean, well, I remember there had been times when, certainly since I've been in office, where we haven't been a party to some statements that may have been made, and then we're questioned for it. And then at that time, I again reiterate, we have an independent foreign policy. We will determine when we join statements and when we do not. But if the statement, of course, is reiterating something that we have publicly said, where we do have a common view, whilst, of course, as I say, maintaining our independent voice and position, then, yeah, we consider that case by case. But every time, it is a decision for us, Corin, and I take that very seriously.
The APEC meeting over the weekend, Donald Trump was at that, the meeting, the leaders' meeting?
He was in attendance. In fact, we had a full suite of leaders, the only replacement being for the President of Mexico.
And what did he say? Did he give any acknowledgement that he was going to be leaving office?
Here I do need to be cautious. The leaders' content of the leaders' meetings are not broadcast, are not televised. It's up to individual leaders whether or not they reflect on their own comments from the meetings. But yes, Donald Trump was in attendance. One of the interesting things, if I may throw this in, Corin, as a consequence that has been publicly reported on, was President Xi from China reflecting on trade as being important to China, and you'll see some of the forward-leaning comments on the CPTPP. So that was a really interesting take-home from that meeting.
It is interesting because at the same time as China is pushing for multilateral trade, in potentially in competition with an America First policy we've seen from the Trump administration, we're also seeing China flex its muscles when it comes to Hong Kong and free speech and these sorts of issues. So New Zealand going to navigate that?
And as we are now, look, you know, this is, we have, in my view, we have a very mature relationship where we are able to express concerns where we have them, but at the same time, we do engage with China constructively on
a range of issues. Well, they just said we run the risk of having our eyes poked out. That doesn't sound that mature.
Well, again, you know, I'm not surprised to have heard a response from China. We have made our views known. They've made their views known. And of course, you know, I am not going to stand in the way of any nation expressing a view when we've just taken the liberty of expressing our own. However, at the same time, I do believe that we have a relationship that allows us to do that. We do, of course, have an important economic relationship with them as well. It is about our ability to navigate both.
Okay, quick run through some domestic issues. Peter Goodfellow's comments that you were, well, a tyrant during the COVID-19 lockdowns.
I'm not going to really read into that particularly. It was the statements made at a political conference, and so I view it with that lens. I have to say, I've been described as many things, but a tyrant isn't one I've heard before, Corin.
The MIQ facilities, RNZ reporting this morning, $500 million for the year, $2 million a day. Is there any way to bring that cost down next year? Could you get, say, those coming back on holiday, et cetera, to pay more?
Yeah, well, look, we are already asking for those who are coming back for short-term reasons, you know, that are within people's control, that if they are doing that, that they will need to pay. Already, you know, we've only just recently had some of those first invoices starting to come up for payment, roughly $500,000 at this stage, and we expect that to grow. And so, yes, we do have that expectation. New Zealanders who are coming home for good, they're coming home for good, so we are treating them differently. But if it's a short-term visit that doesn't need to be made, we're asking people to pay.
Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, thank you very much for your time.
You've been listening to Morning Report Top Stories from RadioNZ.co.nz.